This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. I'm Leland Miller. Thank you so much for being with me. Thank you so much for letting me be with you. You know, I say it all the time. I have no clue what people do at 11 o'clock in the morning, but whatever it is you do, I'm happy that you're doing that do with me. Thank you so much for joining me. Last week, I started out a bit of a series because, you know, I wanted to zero in on kind of mental health and the challenges associated with it, right? I wanted to talk about all things behavior and emotion and mental, right? So we started off with drugs and we did a little bit of autism. And then we kind of just went to people that suffered from untended to medical conditions, right? But I want to double back because I don't know. I really like DMX. And I realize that he's out there a whole lot in the mainstream media and even in social media. And I think the conversation surrounding substance abuse, right? Like, it is one that we do not have enough in our own society. It's one that we don't talk about often. And I will tell you this, in small societies like the Bahamas, drug abuse, is something that we kind of shirk away from. People don't let you know that they enjoy the use of substances. And I can tell you that if you look at the Bahamian society, if you look at all of our entertainment, largely, most of the things that we do as a society is tied around the use or abuse of a substance of some sort. So whether you enjoy homecomings or regattas, they are littered with people excessively consuming the vices of their choice. That is typically the apex of what those functions, what they mean and what they represent. And of course, there is the communal aspect of it where you get to go and see Mama and Tita and Uncle Bala. Yeah. But you do that for 20 minutes and then it's drive me to the site and you go and you get yourself your vice of your choice. Hopefully they're all legal. But in many instances, some of them are not legal. And we don't talk about it, right? And then again, there is the entertainment aspect of it and how much of the substance use, legal or otherwise, or substance abuse, legal or otherwise, that kind of factors into how entertainment is seen and paid for, all right? So we know that the entertainer gets on stage, he becomes a creative person, he then exudes that creativity onto the audience, and he electrifies people, right? And I had with me in studio last week, Candy Gibson. Let me say a special shout out to her. I imagine she's had a really rough week after the show last week, but I don't quite think we landed it, right? And the reason why is because it is one thing to be in public life or to be in the public eye, right? It is another thing for your person to be the energizing source for other people, right? So being in the public sphere is already challenging. But imagine being a guitarist, a bass player, a drummer, a comedian. And every time people see you, what they anticipate or what they expect from you is that you will be in character. What they expect from you is that you will be prepared to go at a minute's notice. You are not allowed to enjoy the social sphere as everyone else is, because whenever you walk into the social sphere, you become a part of the entertainment. So if you go to a band night at a local pub or at a local night spot, instantly, your soiree turns into people wanting you to pick up the instrument that you play, people wanting you to sing a line of the song that you sang, people wanting you to give a little bit of entertainment from the comedian aspect. You go to a wedding and you just came for the social aspect and the ambience, sure. But the minute you get there, right, they have an MC that they're probably already paying, but they want you to come. And the pressure that is involved with that, what does it take to always be in character? particularly, again, I say, and I always tell people, the challenges we face as the Bahamas are quite interesting. And that is because we are a small society with institutions that do not fully function. So where does the comedian in the Bahamas with the drug abuse problem even go? Who does he tell? And how does he ensure that his confession of his own flaw not become the thing that now stops him from being able to eat? Because you know the way we do it in the Bahamas. I'm not giving him any money for him to do what? Go and buy drugs with my money? And we don't think about the greater price, right? Because the truth is, if you gave him money, he's probably going to, and I stole this from Simeon Hall, the chef, most people are going to put money in a way where they categorize it. So even if he does buy drugs with some of it, he won't buy drugs with all of it. And you don't consider it that way. You assume that he's just going to buy drugs with all my money, right? And what does it really matter? At least you've stopped him from doing something else to be able to feed this addiction that has somehow come about as a result of what it is that you require from him. All right? And so I want to talk about that a little bit more. I got a call last week, and I thought that this person was very spot on. And so I invited them to come because I wanted to talk about it a little bit more. Mr. Freddie Munnings is my guest this morning. If you know the name Freddie Munnings, if you know the name Munnings, you know that they've been in, around, between, a part of. They are the voice of entertainment in and around the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. And so I've invited him this morning to come and talk so that we could kind of get a bit more sensitivity surrounding the issue of entertainment and substance abuse, right? And I'm gonna play a little interview by Russell Simmons. Well, not really an interview, but he did a Facebook video, and he talked about how entertainers kind of give their all to record companies, and record companies make millions of dollars, and that after the death of DMX, he realized, and if you know Russell, he's probably one of the biggest managers of one of the biggest brands in America, that people like him have to do a little bit more to make sure they rescue the artist. And I thought that was a very important message because it's not uncommon that you know that there have been great talent among us on the planet. And they all kind of snub away right at the prime of their life. I was actually just thinking about it. If I'm not mistaken, I think Michael Jackson also went at 50. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Whitney Houston went at 50. So you're talking about people that have lived through their youth and right at the peak of their next stage or transition, boom. Finally, the thing that has haunted them for so long catches them. And he talked about what is the obligation of people like him to the people like the DMXs in the community. So Freddie Munnings is with me this morning. Mr. Munnings, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Brother Miller. It's truly a pleasure for me to be here with you. I listen to you regularly, and particularly when you talk about your stint as a Defense Force officer.
Oh, yeah, the best 11 years of my life.
And the mentors that you would have had and the respect that you show them, that is crucially important to me and how you have developed as a result of that relationship. So if you put that in the context of which we speak, the same thing applies. A lot has to do, Liban, in the way you perceive yourself, first of all, self-esteem, self-respect, respect for what you do as an artist, that forms who you are. And before we get started, let me say good morning to your listening audience and those who are listening to you virtually around the world. It's truly an honor for me to have the opportunity to speak to this issue.
Sure.
Because we've all experienced it, personally and otherwise, in the industry. And so for you to have invited me to talk specifically about this and generally, I guess, about the entertainment industry, it's my pleasure. So yes, I totally agree. You know, the clip that you are about to play, I believe, has certain aspects of relevance that we need to understand that what we do and our profession is the business. And you actually identified the problem because you talked about the importance of the artist understanding the product in many instances, the artist is the product.
Right.
Especially in performing arts. And so when you began to believe your quote-unquote propaganda and your promotion mm-hmm. and your marketing, and you walk on a stage and everybody is hollering and screaming, despite what may have happened to you just before walking on that stage mm-hmm. in your personal life, you got to set all of that aside, and those people who is your audience are expecting you to give them and feed that appetite mm-hmm. and that addiction, really, that they have for you in many instances.
Mm.
And you spoke about the adulation of a Michael Jackson mm-hmm. or a Whitney. They actually felt that they were demigods.
Mm-hmm.
And every time that they appear, whether it was on a stage or in the general public, they felt that they had to be on stage.
Mm-hmm.
They had to become the personality that fan, that groupie, that person see them as, this larger than life.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they may have just had one of the worst experiences in their life. They may have experienced something in their personal life that affected them very, very dramatically. But yet, when they appear, they must be this idol, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have that kind of pressure and anxiety, many artists, you hear them talk about stage fright and you
right.
having dabbled in the industry, I'm sure you know what I mean.
Right.
Or just before you about to jump in that water as a Marine, or you about to get on that boat and you know you're going out there to confront
mm-hmm.
some forces that may, at the end of the day, take your life.
Right.
You have a sense of adrenaline. You have a sense of anxiety. All right? And therefore, you then become the product. And so you got to learn how to what? Separate your personal life
mm-hmm.
from your public life.
Mm.
And many of us can't do that.
But there are some people, though, Mr. Munnings, who say, you know, a part of the personal life is what, you know, contributes to the product. I tell people yeah. all the time, right, there are some people who do not even have a substance problem.
Yeah.
You will find, and I always joke about this in cases of Adele and Sam Smith, you know, mm-hmm. and I said, their drug is sadness. Like, mm-hmm. they need to be sad all the time. So I would hate to be
Absolutely.
People in their yeah. social circle, because being melancholy is the thing that fuels the passion in their music, right? And so what about people... What about people that say, well, I don't have a substance problem, but the thing that either fuels the energy that makes them who they are is also something that is unhealthy?
When you study creative arts,
mm-hmm.
and I did some theater early on in my career,
mm-hmm.
part of the technique is to teach you how to tap into your emotion
mm-hmm.
to achieve the objective of the particular scene and or interpretation of what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you are singing about a person that you miss very sorely by virtue of a tragic death, you need to tap into that emotion. In other words, you need to relive that experience to express the sentiments that you are feeling within.
Mm-hmm.
If you are trying to sing about happiness and to celebrate something, the birth of a child or a wedding, or so, you need to tap into what that is. So you are now, as you said, may not need the substance to stimulate you,
mm-hmm.
but you need to tap into the emotion that will stimulate you. And right. in many cases, it's a roller coaster.
Mm-hmm.
And so here again, you now become the product. And once you are the product, you then are perceived to be, I want everybody to like what I'm about to do. I want to be received. Nobody wants to feel that they're doing something that nobody appreciates.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you perform, you 1,000 people in the audience could be responding positively to you. But that one person who you believe is not liking what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
that's a problem for you.
How pervasive is the substance abuse culture in Bahamian entertainment. And I'll tell you why, right? Like, because our communities are so small, it is difficult. Unlike the megastars of the United States and Canada and Europe, you know, when they battle their substance abuse problems, they have the luxury of doing it away from people with massive security, you know, regimes that don't allow cameras or people or outsiders anywhere near them, and so they're able to shelter themselves away. But in a country as small as ours, right? I tell people all the time, I smile when I see people like D-Mark, right? Because he's a personal friend of mine, and I go to Regattas, and he's up on stage, and instantly I know when he becomes D-Mark the Entertainer, right? And you see him on stage, and he has this whole crowd going and going and going and going for 2 hours. Yeah. And then he gets off the stage, and we go back to having regular conversation like he hadn't just been up there. So when you have a community that is this small,
there you go,
where you better pray God you don't have no big security detail, because the Haman won't know who you think you is, right? Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to kind of exile yourself or pull yourself away. You have to live your personality, but live your person, and you have to do it all in the Bahamian society. How pervasive then?
Let me say this to you, my brother. The Bahamian audience for a Bahamian artist is one of the most difficult audiences for him to connect to. Mm. Why? Because he knows you.
Right.
You just talked about it.
Right.
That's D-Mark Mahan.
Yeah.
That's D-Mark.
Yeah, yeah.
If that was Stevie Wonder, oh, that's Stevie Wonder, the superstar. But that's D-Mark. That's my boy.
Right, right.
So he now has the challenge of getting on stage and doing what he does professionally to cause you, his boy or his friend, to appreciate his professionalism, to appreciate his talent, etc. We in the Bahamas, and I know many of my international friends who come here, and I would be walking the street with them or taking them out to fish fry or somewhere, and people say, oh, that's so-and-so over there. Mm-hmm. I remember vividly one time I was out with a very high-profile African-American artist. And, you know, he really was one of these very accomplished. And Bahamians passed by and he said, I love this place. Mm-hmm. I said, what is so special? He said, people don't bother me. Mm-hmm. If he were to go anywhere in the world, everybody would be running to him. Bahamians would hardly come to you and ask you for an autograph.
Oh, yeah.
Because they figure, well, who you think you is?
Yeah.
You know, that's Diana Ross, one time, I believe, made a statement about the fact that she loved the Bahamas so much because she would go into a food store and people would see and recognize her, give her due respect. But they would never come and bother her. Mm-hmm. Because you know why? Bahamians have that kind of persona that we're as good as anybody else. Mm-hmm. Ronnie Butler and I talked about it. They would come and see your show and enjoy it. But you tell him to pay $50 to see you. Well, that's Ronnie, man. Who you think he is? Mm-hmm. Huh? Who you think he is? But you could go somewhere and people pay $100, $200 to see and believe that you are. So I'm saying it's more difficult in this kind of society. Everybody knows you. Mm-hmm. Lemon, like you say, when they hear your voice, they know who you are.
Yeah.
Even if they haven't seen you. I think this may be the first time that I recognize that I'm seeing you in person.
Right.
But I certainly know the voice every time you come on the radio. So because of the smallness of our society, it is more difficult and it puts more pressure on you. And that is why it is very pervasive. The question was, how pervasive is substance abuse in this country? Mm-hmm. Very pervasive. Mm-hmm. And we've known many artists who wouldn't go on stage unless they are stimulated by some substance. Mm. Many of them. And if I name them, you would be shocked.
Wow.
Many of them. And there are some, and you know them, and you've seen them. You see them walking the streets and say, that's so-and-so. That's so-and-so. He used to do this. Many of them end up in these old age homes because they've been abandoned. That is the level of abuse, whether substance or emotional, that we have in this country. Mm. I could name any number of them right now.
So what then, and I think this is a good place to probably play the interview, what then is the responsibility of, and I think the fans have a bit of a responsibility, right? Like
the country has a...
Yeah, I don't think the fans are without responsibility.
Yes,
that's
true.
Like I tell people all the time, I'm perfectly happy to engage you on any level, man, except for when I'm with my three-year-old. Like, please do not require me to be leaving Miller when I am... out here just trying to be his daddy for a couple of minutes because he doesn't understand.
Right.
Right? Like, don't worry about me. I'm good. Like, if you need me, but don't do it to me when I'm with my toddler because he needs me to be his daddy more than anything.
Absolutely.
Right now. But so what is the responsibility that the fan base have? And then what is the responsibility of the companies or the record labels or the production companies that actually benefit from the talent? What obligation do they have to ensure, and we're all men and women, but just to ensure that, you know what, I see Freddie, we enjoy his talent. Freddie is actually a product that helps sell this thing that we sell. But now he's going too far left or too far right. What is the obligation of those entities?
Let's go from the macro to the micro. Mm-hmm. Starting with the government.
Sure.
There are so many, and I've had numerous very, very hard and vehement conversations with major politicians, leaders of this country. And I told them in so many words how they have abandoned our artists and our cultural icons. And you would see it, Lehman, whenever you have a cultural icon who would have passed. The respective leaders would get up in the church or the auditorium and they would talk about how important they were, the contributions they would have made. But when they were in a position to do something to help those persons, they did absolutely nothing.
And even in death, they don't memorialize them.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, something around.
Only for the moment where the camera's on them do they articulate and pontificate about how important this person would have traveled the world to promote the country and the best tourist ambassador in the history of the country. But yet when that person dies or when that person is in need. Mm-hmm. Now, from a country perspective, from a societal perspective, we don't appreciate the level of a work that goes into becoming a professional. We see it as quote unquote playing music or you having fun on stage. So to you, to the general public, many times you're having a good time, man. Why should we consider that to be important in terms of you're having proper insurance, you're having proper pensions? You're having proper medical attention. As musicians, as entertainers in this country, I would say as much as 80% of them may not have a medical insurance.
Right.
So if they were to get ill, where would they end up?
Right.
More than likely on the public ward. And there's nothing wrong with that now, but do you get the best care at that level? Do you have people who are concerned about you? If the same thing were to happen in other places, these artists would be celebrated. They would be immortalized in many cases because of the contributions that they would have made, right? But because their familiarity, again, that you talked about earlier, that's Lehman, man. I mean, you know, look at him. You think he can't do better?
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what you're going through.
Right.
They don't know the anxiety and the pressure that's imposed upon you. And when you are having a great time and they partying with you and you buying everybody around, but then when you go home or you become ill and there is no work, for example, some of us, due to COVID, have not worked in 18 months.
Right.
Have not performed in 18 months to generate any income whatsoever.
Right.
Where is the pension fund? Where is the disaster fund? Where is the relief for the artist? First thing they do, they can take your house. Children can't go to school. You can't pay your light bill. You can't pay your water bill. Imagine you
and
now.
And people say, why can't you go do something else?
The
because
superstar.
I'm a guitar player, right.
You put in just enough, more than enough energy and perfecting your craft than the fellow who may be a carpenter.
Right.
And they say that, well, you should go. Well, some of us will go and do other things. We're forced to do it. But you see, here's that ego again. I am a superstar. I am a celebrity. I'm not going to go and wash cars on the side of the road. I'm not going to go and sell hot dogs or peanuts on the side of the road to make a dollar. I'm not going to go and wait tables. Some do. Many do.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are those, like you say, those at that level of achievement. And I can tell you some horror stories, my brother, horror stories that I know personally of some of our artists. But here we don't put together that what we call a safety net for them. Mm-hmm. Right? And I'm not saying that they don't have responsibility, because when you're doing well, you should try to make provisions for the time when you're, you know, the 7 year of feast and the 7 year of famine.
Right. But people with problems, Mr. Munnings, don't readily identify their problems. A lot of times, you don't know that you're in trouble until you're in trouble.
That is absolutely
correct. You don't realize you're stuck out to sea till you're stuck. And, you know, again, there must be an obligation bigger than the artist, right? Like, because I tell people all the time, I say this without fear of reproach. When it comes to stage presence and entertainment in the Commonwealth of the Bahamas, I don't think that there is any performer in my lifetime that can eclipse that of a Lawrence Roll. Mm-hmm. But the man is over 50 now, which means the Lawrence that I enjoyed 20 years ago that could jump off a stage, if he jumps off of a stage today, he may require some medical attention.
I enjoy him too.
Right.
He really is captivating.
But we don't ever consider the wear and tear being the entertainment. I watched something from Steve Harvey the other day. He's getting ready to start a new series of the game show he does on TV.
Yeah.
And he was talking about, like, he does a game show, but like what he got to do to get amped to go on TV.
Absolutely.
And so, like, people don't calculate it. So you see him out there, you see the nice suit. He's been in the background listening to Rhythm and Blues for the last 2 hours, just trying to get himself
mental
space. Right. And so there is the wear and tear on the artist. Mm-hmm. There is the wear and tear on the entertainer. Mm-hmm. Of course, I have somebody that always tells me, oh, well, you know, the entertainer has an obligation to make sure that he creates a product that he doesn't have to continue to sell himself, but he sells the product.
And that is true.
And I get that. Yeah. But someone, like I may be the best soloist in the world, the best vocalist on the planet. I may be the best guitarist on the planet. Mm-hmm. Does that mean I'm a good businessman? It may not mean.
Absolutely not.
I again watched an interview from DMX, and he said one of the people that he credited most in his coming up in the industry was Prince. And the reason he did it was because Prince walked over to him in a nightclub one night, right? He says, and he also didn't use the Prince voice. He said, hey, you, come over here. Mm-hmm. He didn't know Prince could talk like that, right? So he said... Prince said to him, you know, I think you're a talented artist and I'd like to make music with you in the future. On one condition, do you own your masters? And DMX said he had been making music for about 10 years.
They don't understand.
No one had ever talked to him or explained to him the importance of, one, owning the master, and two, owning the music.
They don't understand the business.
But that didn't take away from the fact that he was a great artist.
Great artist.
That according to his own manager, the label manager, so this guy brought our business out of the rut.
That is correct.
But who has an obligation?
The show, they don't know the business.
Right.
Show business.
Someone has to have an obligation to the talent.
Absolutely. But you see, it is your responsibility as an artist to learn what it is your business is about. Mm-hmm. To a certain degree, that's your responsibility.
Okay.
If you look at athletes, if you look at profession, if you look at doctors, medical doctors, if you look at many professionals, they are some of the worst business people in the world. They know how to do a heart, open heart surgery, but they don't know how to run a business. Business is a specific. That's why they have managers. That's why they have agents. That's why they have lawyers. Mm-hmm. What we do not do, Brother Miller, is we don't understand the business we are in. See, I look at myself as an artist, yes, but I also look at myself as a businessman. My college degree was in business administration.
Okay.
So I understand that this is a business. Mm-hmm. And so when I write a song, I make sure it's copyrighted. Mm-hmm. I make sure it's published properly. All right? When I produce a show, I make sure that I have a contract that pay me my money when I'm supposed to be paid. Mm-hmm. And most instances, you get paid before you perform, because once you perform,
you
get all the hell in the world.
You can't take it back. That's like the funeral service. The body in the ground.
Forget it, brother. You can't take it back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm saying we have failed. Mm-hmm. And that's why for many years you may hear me talk about the importance of copyright and publishing and the business of music. Mm-hmm. Because we have not taught. All we know is I'm a great performer. Mm-hmm. I am a talented. People love my singing. Mm-hmm. But how many artists around the world? I'll just look at all the international artists around the world that have fallen into the same category.
Right. And there are people that have been in the industry for years.
And those who tried to do it, they were eliminated. Mm. They were actually taken out. people like the Sam Cooks of this world and, right. and the Jimi Hendrix, who even ventured to get into the business of music to right. protect their interests, they had some serious issues. Mm-hmm. And they were even fed the substance that would cause them to do certain things. Mm-hmm. Because that's way... Billie Holiday? Mm-hmm. Major. I mean, you know the life stories. Mm-hmm. Whitney Houston. Mm-hmm. Michael Jackson. They were dependent. And in many cases, there are theories that people kept them dependent to right. control them.
Yeah.
And so, yes, in the Bahamas, we have that issue. It's a serious issue. We need to educate our people. We need to teach our people. And, you know, we have institutions that are supposed to do this. But it's the responsibility. If you're going to decide to become a Marine officer, mm-hmm. or if you're going to decide to become a doctor, you're going to prepare yourself. And you're going to study and train. But you also need to understand that once I have my practice, I need to know how I'm going to protect my investment and my income. Mm. So you hire the proper people to do that, mm. or you do it yourself. In many instances, you would notice that when you go to a doctor, he never talks to you about money.
Yeah, he sends you back out front.
Go out front and yeah. talk to my agent out front.
Yeah, you can't ask him for no discount.
When you, as an artist, first thing you're supposed to do is to be able to get yourself a manager and a booking agent. You're never supposed to discuss money with the client mm-hmm. in the real world. Mm-hmm. When I traveled all over the world, I never talk. All I get is a call is you are signed, you have been booked to go so and so and so and so and so, and here's your deposit. Mm-hmm. My booking agent and my managers and my producers dealt with that stuff.
But there is also some abuse there as well, because you know,
absolutely.
They have people like
absolutely.
Mike Tyson once said that he's been a millionaire.
That's right.
And he says that he believed that he could have been a billionaire had it not been for managers.
Because in the manipulation of the contractual arrangement with him, you see, you got to have someone to check the checker. Mm-hmm. If I'm booking you as an agent. Mm-hmm. You should have a personal lawyer looking after your contracts mm-hmm. to ensure that you get what you're supposed to get. Mm-hmm. People like Tyson and others, you know, mega artists, you know, they will arrange for you to have the biggest party you want to have. What mm-hmm. you want? You want caviar? What you want? Whatever you want. You want girls? You want chauffeur-driven limousines? Sure, no problem. Little did you know, you're paying for that. Mm-hmm. You, mm-hmm. the artist mm-hmm. or the athlete, is paying for that. Mm-hmm. Because when you see your accountants and you see your statements, you will say, okay, you made $1 million, but you owe me now $500,000 because you have spent your million plus $500,000 of mine. No, this happens.
Yeah.
And so now you are obligated to give me another contract.
Yeah.
You're obligated to give me another 2 albums.
Right.
Because you have overspent. Sammy mm-hmm. Davis tells that story very, very well. He was so committed that he was performing. All they had to do was tell him how high to jump. Mm. So the bottom line is, it's a business. And unless we teach our young artists, and we try to have seminars. As a matter of fact, I served on the Orange Economy Subcommittee. Mm-hmm. One of the first things we recommended is that we must have an institution where we teach our artists the business of music mm-hmm. or the business of entertainment. Mm-hmm. Copyright, publishing, management, promotion, marketing. All of these things, it's a business. It's an industry.
Sure. I want to get this interview. I want to get yes. this recording in from Mr. Russell from yes. Def Jam. Yes. So, Alan, then play that for me. And he talks about what it is the entertainer meant to his business.
Yes.
And how, retrospectively, he doesn't think that himself or his company went far enough to protect an artist who obviously yes. had a problem.
Very rarely the company goes to that point.
Yeah, let's play the clip.
So, we lost our brother. It's just starting to sink in. I feel a lot of emotions. I have a story, a number of stories, but I'll tell one. We weren't doing very well at Def Jam, and I was in Malibu. I think I was more focused on other companies. But Kevin and Leo sent me a young executive by the name of Irv Gotti. And Irv came to me and he was bouncing. This is how it's gotta go, man. It's gotta be like this. And he was talking about the way the beat had to feel, right? Just a kind of a typical thing an A&R director might do, and that's what Irv was doing. It's like, that's what we gotta do. And I remember getting on the Stairmaster and he started to talk, and I remember staying on the Stairmaster for an hour, which was almost double what I usually did 40 minutes or so. So for an hour I interviewed this young man, and of course, Leo and Kevin already had their minds set on hiring him, so I approved him and he went to work. And I kept thinking about the way the music had to sound, the way he was animated and excited. And then, not too long after that, I remember doing an interview on Hot 97, and I heard a record by the Lox. And there's a part in the record, and most of you hip-hop fans know it, he said, back the truck up. Like, wow, what is this? And then he wasn't a member of the Lox, and I called the office and I said, I just heard the most amazing vocalist. And Leo said, oh, he's signed to us. So I went to the office and I heard Get At Me Dog. And it was, to me, so special because Def Jam was built and based on loud, aggressive, abrasive music and vocals to match. That's what we were, loud, we were alternative. And that was the most alternative record I had heard in our office for a long time. It epitomized what we thought Def Jam was supposed to be. Other records were out, you know, they were more polished, they were more R&B. And we kind of rebelled. From the beginning, we talked about how Def Jam didn't do that. Of course, the world was changing and we were falling behind because there was lots of melody in music. Hip hop was melodic, but nothing like Get At Me Dog. And Get At Me Dog was going against the grain and reminded me of what we loved at Def Jam. So I was so excited. I remember going to the Tunnel when he first performed it and watching him perform it, like, wow, Def Jam is back. Sure enough, he saved Def Jam. And it was a moment for us, and lots of other things happened around that time, and Def Jam exploded. But he pulled us out of the mud and brought us back to life. He also made it exciting for me. And Earl Simmons was a hero, a personal hero of mine, and a music hero for me. His music and what he and Rough Riders created was so special. And what Irv Gotti helped him create, helped to bring us, was so special. So Irv was the A&R director who oversaw that project. Anyway, I feel like he saved us, but we didn't save him. Of course, people say, oh, save yourself, but no, we should have given him more love. And we have to be responsible to the next DMX. This has to be a teachable moment. There are so many teachable moments about artists, the Kurt Cobains of the world, and, you know, and of course, DMX. And there's many different, people have many different theories about what actually was the, how he died. But he struggled and he suffered. I remember the last time I saw him, a couple of years ago, I believe he came directly from the rehab to my old neighborhood to meet up with me so that we could meet with gang members, so we could stop the violence, because there was a lot of in Queens. He came to Queens and he gave of himself. And he said some of the things I said to them before him, but when he said it, they listened. He had a way of saying things that people could digest, and especially those kids in Queens. So he came to help us. He saved our music company. I'm sure that day he saved some lives, and we didn't save him. So it's a teachable moment for me to be more responsible when I can, to reach out to those in need, to just be better. Personally, I don't take full responsibility. I'm just one person. But I should have taken more responsibility. And he's going to now leave us a legacy of one of the greatest music artists, certainly 70 million records, and changing the way we sounded in reaffirming Def Jam's place in history and having a heart of gold. Those are the characteristics that I can ascribe to him. DMX had a heart of gold. He was a loving, beautiful person who wanted the best for everyone. He was always in struggle, but always in prayer. He gave the best of himself, the best that he could, and we should have, I think, given him better. It's just the way I'm feeling this morning. I hope that I know that we will celebrate him. I know that God will receive him. That day that he came to Queens, he didn't have to come. And I remember the enthusiasm that he had when he knew that he could affect the lives of others. I remember the prayer he gave. I remember the discussions he had with each of the gang members. And I remember their eyes lit up listening. Just like that whole generation's eyes lit up every time his songs played and they listened. So God bless you, DMX. God will receive you. God bless your family. And I'm praying that people around you get some peace. I know you're at peace now. And I'm deeply, deeply appreciative to have been a part of your life, however small. You're a big part of mine. Thank you so much.
And so, Freddie, you know, right out the gate, you hear things like, you know, this man saved our record label. He was a musical hero to me. You also heard him talk about the neglect of the artist for his own personal self to continue to provide the product, right? So he says he came from rehab.
Yes.
I don't know how long the process was. Sometimes I understand it's a 2-week, 3-week process of being resident at rehab facilities. But imagine to drive yourself from there straight to another event, basically, that the record label has booked for you. Like, you know, you just have to show up. And who knows? I mean, like, who knows the challenge behind having to always be that?
Let me tell you a brief story, because I know you're almost out of time.
Mm-hmm.
This year, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Funky Nassau.
Mm-hmm.
Funky Nassau is perhaps the biggest song in the history of the record industry in the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
It has been covered by more than 200 artists all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
That song was responsible for the direction of disco music throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
This is recorded by the gentleman who was the original owner of a company called Tune Distributors,
mm-hmm.
which produced my brother Raphael, T Connection, mm-hmm. Casey and the Sunshine Band, Betty Wright, and the list goes on and on. He said that that particular song, that particular beat, the same thing that Russell is talking mm-hmm. about, changed the direction of the music industry in the United States and was the original sound that created what we now know as the Miami sound.
Mm-hmm.
Pre Gloria Estefan and all of them,
mm-hmm.
Casey and everybody else. That's a story that has not been told. And my brother is preparing the documentary on that, Raphael Munnings, who was mm-hmm. the original artist,
mm-hmm.
along with Dr. Off.
Mm-hmm.
And you would remember that Compass Point, which was owned by Chris Blackwell,
mm-hmm.
started here in the Bahamas, Island Records.
Okay.
Dr. Off's, Tyrone Fitzgerald, who was a first cousin of mine, and Raphael and others, were some of the original artists who recorded at Compass Point. And the music was so powerful. We believe, and this is my theory, that that music was repressed, was compressed, because it would have rivaled some of the biggest names in the music industry today.
Mm.
And it was done by the producers and the managers at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We understand what Russell is talking about. Yes, record companies are not interested in you. They're interested in what you can do for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he's talking about. He regrets it now. But at the time, maybe him not personally, but his record company, they're not interested in Laban Miller. What can you do to advance the music of my company and sell my music. They're interested in what you do. You don't make money from records mm-hmm. as an artist. Mm-hmm. The record company makes money from artists, because what artists don't realize, that every dime that is spent on your production, you pay it back. Mm-hmm. Because you only get a percentage of the royalties of the sales. If you don't write the song, if you don't record, and sometimes when you write the song, the record company owns the copyright. Mm. Because you don't know any better. And in many cases, they steal it when you do know better. And they hire the biggest lawyers in the world to protect themselves. So that's a whole nother, again, this is a huge, the entertainment business is the biggest business in the world. Mm-hmm. Bigger than any other industry in the world. When you think about it, television, radio,
entertainment, boxing,
sports, music, yeah. dance, theater, it's all entertainment.
Right.
Casinos,
yeah.
it's all entertainment.
And people consume it. People consume it. They have a voracious appetite
Absolutely.
For entertainment.
Because people need to be uplifted.
Yeah.
When in the worst of times is when we as creative artists are supposed to be at our best.
Right.
When disasters are hit, or during the Great Depression in the 30s, is when you produce some of the best music in the world. Mm-hmm. And coming out of COVID, you're going to see some great music because people are hurting.
Yeah.
And we as artists need to write music and produce creative arts and paint paintings that will uplift our people.
Yeah.
And give them hope once again.
Yeah. You actually see it already because I'm sitting here, I'm thinking that there is one song that was released during the COVID pandemic that I can't get out of my mind.
Okay.
Sang by Nishi Ellis. I don't know if you've ever heard it. I don't know what the name of it is, but it kind of has the beat splish splash. What is it? But every time I hear it, it literally sends me crazy.
We are social creatures. Mm-hmm. When you go home as a man mm-hmm. and your baby is hungry and your wife is on you because you only pay the bills, that drives you to a point where you may blow your mind and blow your brains out because of the pressure that society puts on us as people. You need an upliftment. Whenever you go to a funeral, what do they do to bring comfort? They sing music, or they play music, or they read poetry, or they give a tribute, right? When you have a baby born to celebrate that baby's life,
right.
or back in the African tradition, every time there's a significant event, there is music and dancing. That's why we are so creative. That's why we're so rhythmic, because of our ancestry. It's time to go to harvest, there's music. Yeah. It's time for us to reap the harvest, is music. Time for us to plant, time for a baby birth, time for death, there is music. Before the preacher comes, and you know this,
Huh? Matter of fact, Rev got his favorite chorus.
Next voice you will hear after the choir sings.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
why
yes.
is that?
Yes.
That puts you in the mindset.
Yeah.
When you go into war,
they
play in that music, brother.
Yeah. The band goes, there's a reason the band is ahead of the men that march.
That
gives them the marching pace.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mr. Munnins, we're flat out of time, but I mean, I thank you so much for coming, because I think this is something that I think people need to begin to pay attention to.
Well, I appreciate your sensitivity.
Yeah, it's called the price of entertainment.
Absolutely.
And sometimes, like war, people pay for it with their lives.
Absolutely.
We've seen it in the case of DMX.
No
We've
question
seen it in
about
the case
it.
Of Whitney Houston, Michael Jackson, and the list gets longer and longer and longer.
And some of those who are the most creative are those who are in most pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
That because is they connect.
That is something. Thank you very much for coming, Mr. Munnings. Anyway, you hear my music. That means I'm flat out of time. You know the voice. It's Levin Miller. Again, I don't know what you people do at 11 o'clock, but I'm happy that you did whatever it was that you were doing, and you did it with me. Don't move, though. This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, the station for fresh news and smart talk. So they've got the news, and it's next.
Justice is juxtapositioning us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground.